Good morning and welcome. My name is Joel Huberman, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Dr. Alan Hirschfeld. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as catalysts to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within just a few days. Our speaker today is Dr. Alan Hirschfeld, the well-known writer and teacher, famous for his ability to explain difficult physical and astronomical concepts in words that lay people can understand and enjoy. Dr. Hirschfeld grew up in New Jersey, close to the lights of New York City, not an ideal environment for a boy with a budding interest in astronomy. Nevertheless, young Alan persisted, purchasing a commercial small reflector telescope for $84 in saved up coins. Time passed. He went on to obtain a bachelor's degree in astrophysics from Princeton and a doctoral degree in astronomy from Yale. His academic career led him to his current positions as an associate of the Harvard College Observatory and as professor of physics at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth, where he has won two awards for excellence in teaching. One of Professor Hirschfeld's recent books is called Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. It is an explanation of the methods used by astronomers to accurately estimate distances to stars and galaxies. Another is entitled The Electric Life of Michael Faraday. This one is a biography of one of the greatest scientists of the 19th century, the man who first figured out the interactions between electricity and magnetism, and who at the same time was remarkable both for overcoming adversity, for advocating the importance of science, and for his generosity. In today's lecture, Professor Hirschfeld will introduce us to the fascinating men and women of his most recent book. He calls these scientists Starlight Detectives, which is also the title of his book. You are about to hear how, using only the clues contained in starlight, these detectives discovered the modern universe. Welcome, Professor Hirschfeld.
Well, thank you, Joel, for that kind introduction. I'm delighted to be here today. This is such a wonderful space. I've been a college professor now for 38 years, and I'm really not used to being in a lofty position like this. The lecture halls at my university, I'm down there. The lectern is down there, and the students are above me. But we'll see how this arrangement works out. There's a saying that we all know: a picture is worth a thousand words. Astronomers have a variation on that saying. A picture is worth a thousand words. A spectrum is worth a thousand pictures. Pictures and spectra, the camera and the spectroscope, these devices together revolutionized astronomy in the latter half of the 1800s into the early 1900s. And the people responsible for taking the camera and the spectroscope and actually making them usable devices for astronomy, it's a very varied bunch. There are amateur astronomers, there are inventors, as the subtitle of my book says, there are eccentrics, although most of these people doing astronomy at night in their backyards when they should be asleep, probably were somewhat eccentric according to their neighbors. But these are the people, these are the starlight detectives that I discovered and wrote the book about. So I would like to tell you about them and about the camera and the spectroscope. So let's go way, way back. Observation of the night sky, what we now call astronomy, has been a deliberate human activity since the dawning of our species. Our prehistoric ancestors presumably witnessed a wide range of celestial events, some regular and predictable, like the rising and setting of the sun, and others disturbingly, confoundingly unpredictable. I imagine that these prehistoric people were attuned to any alterations in the architecture of the night sky, the momentary streak of a meteor, the visitation, the intrusion of a ghostly comet, the alarming spectacle of a solar eclipse. In the starry vault above their heads, early humans conjured outlines of beasts and beings from their own mythological tales. They sought harbingers of the future. Yes, astronomy began as astrology. Some of my students at the end of the semester thanked me for the astrology course that I have taught. And these early humans, I imagine, again, prehistoric, sought clues to the moods of the spirits, the gods who controlled, who governed their world. So since that time, that long ago time, through the rise and fall of successive civilizations, up until the near modern era, people observed the heavens with the one astronomical instrument that they had at their disposal, the human eye. The eye was the first astronomical instrument, but it has serious deficiencies, thanks to the logic of evolution. First of all, the eye is optimized for daytime use. It doesn't work very well at night. You can't see colors very well at night unless they're illuminated by a street lamp. Now, as Joel mentioned, I did my first astronomy 8 miles outside of Manhattan, so there was never night. And what I thought was night, you know, was sort of just a lesser version of day with all the street lights around. I didn't know what night was until I attended the Enchanted Skies Star Party near Socorro, New Mexico. And I remember at night standing on this plain ringed by mountains, and I couldn't see my feet. I couldn't see anything around me. The only thing I could see was what was above my head. And so I really felt a connection to our forebears who lived in the darkness at night, and basically the only thing to see if they were outside was the beautiful vault of the heavens. So the eye is a daytime instrument. It has no capacity to accumulate light, to create a time exposure, to build up an image. The eye has a very narrow band of color sensitivity, from red to violet, the familiar colors of the rainbow, or the visible spectrum as it's known. But already back in the 1800s, it was known, it was demonstrated, that there are forms of light to which the eye is not sensitive. Beyond the red, there is infrared light. Beyond the violet end of our visible spectrum is ultraviolet light. And of course, later on, we found out about X-rays and radio waves. These are all forms of light. They just differ in wavelength, but our eye is sensitive to a very, very narrow, narrow band of all the possible light that there could be in the universe that could flow into our telescopes. The eye, as well, can't analyze a light beam to tell what its constituent colors are. It doesn't have a prismatic ability. The amalgamated colors in a light beam, they just pour into the eye and they flood the retina at the same time. We can't tell how much of the image that we see consists of blue shades versus red shades, yellow shades. It's all together in one multicolored image. So these are the deficiencies, the major deficiencies, at least as far as astronomy goes. Now, we all know as well that in the early 1600s, there was a tremendous technological boost to astronomy, and that was the introduction of the telescope. So when you read about Galileo's discoveries with his very, very crude telescope, it's just amazing. You can imagine being back in the day and reading of these wonders that nobody had ever seen in the entire history of civilization. Mountains on the moon, phases of the planet Venus, and of course the moons of Jupiter. So from that point, telescopes gradually grew bigger. Galileo's was merely an inch wide. Telescopes grew more refined, both optically and mechanically, but even well into the 1800s, all telescopes retained a common flaw. At the business end of the telescope, the human eye. So the telescope was behaving like a light funnel. It did funnel more light into the human eye, but the deficiencies of the human eye were still present. And also, if an astronomer back in the days, the last days of visual astronomy, if an astronomer wanted to show a friend what was seen through a telescope, there was no picture to be taken. The person had to be there. The friend had to be there and look into the eyepiece. The only way to record what an astronomer saw, say back in the 1840s, 1830s, was a written description and a drawing. And I can tell you by example that astronomers are not necessarily good artists. So, you know, looking back at some of these early drawings of celestial objects, they bear little resemblance to the actual form of the physical object as we know it today with photography. So, in a sense, I suspect that the old visual astronomers, when they were sketching what they were seeing through the eyepiece, a sight always just at the limit of vision, various shades of gray, hard to see, I have a feeling that their brain was sort of photoshopping in more details than what was really evident in the eyepiece. And other astronomers complained about this tendency, that what was shown in a drawing, certainly later they showed that that didn't bear much correlation to what was able to be pictured later. So, for astronomy to become a truly modern science, which it of course is today and has been now for many decades, astronomers had to replace the human eye with something better. Astronomers had to accept that there was another way, a better way, of seeing the universe than actually looking at it. And many professional astronomers were reluctant to give up the eye. Seeing is believing, and their jobs hinged on visual observations. So we have this situation where in the 1840s, astronomers, the professionals, are very comfortably at their telescopes with their eye, looking, studying objects, keeping track of the movements of planets and such. And then on the scene comes these new technologies. They have no interest in them. at all. So it was left to others, the amateur astronomers. So these two new instruments, as I already mentioned, the camera and the spectroscope. Let's talk first about the camera. Photography virtually burst on the scene in January of 1839. Now, I ask you to put yourself back in 1839 or 1838. There's no such thing as photography. I mean, there is, but nobody knows about it because all these experiments are conducted in secret since the 1820s. So there's a picture in my book, and I actually brought a copy of this picture along. I forgot to put it out there when you were coming in, but I'll put it in the snack area afterwards so you can see what I'm going to be talking about now. Notre Dame, a picture of Notre Dame from 1838, before the announcement that photography exists. The locale was at once familiar, and unlike anything Francois Arago had ever seen, there, on the southern flank of the Ile de la Cité, rose the towers and flying buttresses of Notre Dame Cathedral. To either side arched the elegant stone bridges Arago had often crossed over the Seine, although today their arrangement was oddly reversed, with Pont l'Archeveche on the left and Pont Saint-Louis on the right, instead of the other way around. The river itself had a curious unearthly sheen, its normally agitated surface smoothed into a silvery ribbon, so still that it mirrored the bridge abutments. Remarkably, the entire scene was rendered in myriad shades of gold-tinted gray, as if nature's pigments had been scrubbed away only to reveal the fine-lined sketch underneath. Yet even to Francois Arago's practiced eye, the colors of Paris were hardly missed amid the vibrant interplay between light and dark. Were he not a man of science, in fact, director of the Paris Observatory and permanent secretary of the French Academy of Science, Arago might have sworn that he was witnessing a miracle. But the 6x8-inch metal slab onto which this diminutive slice of Paris had seemingly been shrunk was the product of human invention. Its secretive creator, Louis Daguerre, an acclaimed painter of theatrical sets, must have been pleased with Arago's response to his picture. He had expended years of solitary labor on this endeavor and was ready at last to reap the profits. Daguerre offered Arago a magnifying glass and suggested that he take a closer look at the picture. Arago pored over Daguerre's metal plate through the lens. The more he screwed up his eyes, the more he found himself drawn into the encyclopedic still life, whose every recess held a further surprise. Under magnification, every window mullion, every roof tile, every cobblestone was crisply delineated. Notre Dame's varied surfaces became a tumble of tiny Euclidean forms, its spires, needle-like slashes against the brilliant sky. The scene seemed almost too realistic to be real, possessing a fineness of detail that made a mockery of human vision. Arago put down the magnifier. As to Daguerre's picture, he could draw no other conclusion. Regardless of how fine the brush, how keen the eye, how steady the hand, this was no trick of the painter's palette. No artist who ever lived could have created such an excruciatingly accurate scene. So far, it stood above human capability. Arago's course was as clear as the wondrous image before him. He had to convince Louis Daguerre to divulge his secret method. And he did, with a little money. Actually, with a lot of money. The French government recognized the invention of photography, at least as Daguerre had carried it out, as so valuable that nobody should own the patent to it. So it was made public. Daguerre was given a lifetime pension, everybody was happy, and within a few months, the steps to create a photograph were published for everybody. Photography swept Europe, swept the United States, I guess I should say now, swept Europe and Britain and the United States. Photography studios popped up in Boston, in Philadelphia, in New York. This was in the 1840s. Photography became suddenly very, very popular. People wanted their portraits. Landscape photographs were taken. It was everywhere. And certainly by the Civil War, we know those chilling Matthew Brady images of the fallen soldiers. So why did it take until the 1890s for photography to be applied to astronomy? Well, basically, it was hard. It was hard to take pictures through a telescope. It was hard enough to take pictures without a telescope, but through a telescope, near impossible, at least from the professional astronomer's point of view. So why is celestial photography so difficult? Well, celestial objects, as we know, with notable exception of the sun, maybe the moon, they tend to be pretty faint. Remember, a star is basically a sun, but so far away that it's just a little speck of light. And in terms of these fuzzy nebulae that you can see through telescopes, gas clouds, star clusters and such, extremely faint, even to the eye. And the early photographic chemicals were not very light sensitive. So to capture even something like the moon or a star in a camera through a telescope was very difficult. It required a long time exposure, many minutes, later on many hours, even for something like the moon. Also, these celestial objects, they don't really cooperate when they're having their portrait taken. They don't sit still in the sky. They move out away from the field of view of the camera because the Earth rotates. So the camera is fixed to a telescope, which is fixed to the ground, which is the Earth, which is rotating. So since that whole arrangement is moving one way, the stars appear to move the other way in the sky. So a telescope had to have some kind of mechanical drive, a clockwork, that would move it so that it actually counteracted the rotation of the Earth. And it had to be extremely accurate. The subject had to sit still. And this was not easily accomplished in the mid-1800s. And there was also inertia from the professional astronomers. As I already mentioned, and as Joel mentioned as well, the kind of astronomy that was done was not point your telescope out to the sky and see what new thing you can discover. It was more or less celestial map making, measuring the positions of planets and comets and stars as finely as you could to create maps of the night sky. And also to test Newton's theory of gravity, which would determine how planets move. Do the planets move the way that Newton predicted they would? That's what the professionals did, highly mathematical. And so why would they abandon that and take on some untested and really messy and noxious process? They just didn't see that this was something that was viable for them. And so into this vacuum came the amateur astronomers, the tinkerers, the inventors, the people who really made the camera and made the spectroscope what it could be. So in the book, I introduce you to many, many people whose names not even my professional colleagues have ever heard of. I'm just going to tell you about a few of them so you get some sense of the range of skills that were brought to practical astronomy. There's the Boston photographer, John Adams Whipple, very well known at the time as a studio photographer. So in the late 1840s and early 1850s, he marched up the hill in Cambridge to the new Harvard College Observatory, with their brand new telescope, biggest refractor telescope in the world, and basically, you know, he has a camera here, and he asked, can I take a picture through your telescope? Equally amazing is that they said, okay, sure. So the first test was on a day like today. He attached this camera to the tail end of the biggest telescope, an expensive telescope. You know, this couldn't happen today. And they tried to take a picture of the sun. That experiment ended when the director of the observatory found that his sleeve was on fire. They decided to stick with nighttime objects after that, and within a couple of years, Whipple and the astronomers at Harvard took the first photograph of a star, a well-known star, Vega. Took 90 seconds for that exposure. They took the first high-quality pictures of the moon, which still look pretty good today. But you can imagine, when they were put on display at the big International London Exposition in 1851, people's jaws dropped on this little plate, the moon. The moon was there. How did the moon get there? Who painted that? It took a little while to understand what a photograph actually was. And Whipple also took the first photograph of a planet, the planet Jupiter. So we move ahead another decade. There's a fellow named Lewis Morris Rutherford. He's a New York City lawyer who decided to abandon the law and marry a wealthy Stuyvesant and take up astronomy as a hobby. So he photographed star clusters from a little enclosure in back of his mansion in downtown New York City, and then invented a tabletop machine that would measure the locations of all of the stars on that photographic plate. In the 1880s, we have Henry Draper, a New York City physician, and Andrew Common in England, sanitation engineer. They independently took the first photographs of the Orion Nebula. If you look at the first photograph of the Orion Nebula, Henry Draper's first photograph, it's completely underwhelming. You see a few stars and like there's a haze, but within a year, he had taken pictures that really were striking, and Common even surpassed that. The Orion Nebula is this billowy, billowy cloud that you can actually see with the unaided eye during the winter time. And it had been studied literally for centuries, and in one fell swoop, you had a better image of the Orion Nebula from Andrew Common than you did from centuries of drawings. In the same decade, 1880s, Isaac Roberts, a Welsh-born builder living in England, he had a telescope made for him that was just for photography. You couldn't even look through the telescope. It was just for photography. He would line it up with something and he would take a time exposure. He took a panoramic photograph of the Andromeda Nebula, nowadays known as the Andromeda Galaxy. That too is a celestial object that you can see from a dark location just by eye. When he showed this as a lantern slide at a meeting of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1888, there were audible gasps. And if you look at that picture, you get some sense of why the professionals would have been so struck by this photograph that was better by orders of magnitude than any drawing of the Andromeda Nebula. In 1890s, now we start to get the professional astronomers in on this innovative method. And they're starting to realize, hey, there's a comet on my photograph of that star that nobody's ever seen before. Ooh, an asteroid on this picture that I've discovered. And James Keeler, who was a professional astronomer, a highly trained astrophysicist, He worked at the Lick Observatory in California, which still exists. He was working with Andrew Common's telescope. This telescope that used to be in the lowlands of England was donated and shipped to a mountaintop in California and was reused there to take photographs of the night sky. And they were incredible photographs. And the key thing about James Keeler's 1890s photographs was not so much the object that he was photographing, various kinds of nebulae and star clusters, but around each of these objects, in what had been thought of as sort of empty space, there were these little spiral wisps of light, lots and lots of them, on every photograph that he took. And he estimated that if he were to photograph the entire sky with this telescope, the total number of these little spiral nebulae would run up into the hundreds of thousands, later raised into the millions, and nowadays raised into the, well, countless. So the presence of this huge agglomeration of spiral nebulae never before seen, this galvanized professional astronomers, and they piled in. Every observatory then wanted to get its camera and start snapping pictures of deep space. So it was Keeler's photographs that really started to alter astronomers' perception of what the universe was. Maybe it wasn't just our galaxy surrounded by empty space. Maybe there were a lot of galaxies out there. And that brings us then to the second essential instrument that the starlight detectives perfected, and that is the spectroscope. So we have to dial back our timeline to the early 1800s. Even by that time, it was known that, you know, you send sunlight through a prism, you get a rainbow, technically a spectrum, and, you know, Roy G. Biv, all those colors. But around 1815, a German optical craftsman named James Fraunhofer examined the sun's spectrum not so much from an aesthetic point of view, wow, look at that rainbow, but from a scientific point of view. He examined it in detail, and he found that this seemingly continuous array of rainbow colors was actually interrupted by hundreds of dark lines, hairlines, absences of certain colors. So he made note of that, he published a paper about it, and then, well, basically things sat still from there until 1859. So many, many decades passed, and the German scientists Robert Bunsen and Gustav Kirchhoff made a crucial discovery about these dark lines in the sun's spectrum. Before I get to that crucial discovery, I love these guys. This Bunsen-Kirchhoff duo, they are amazing, amazing human beings. And you can sort of imagine the joy that they must have had working together and knowing each other as friends and colleagues. So first about Bunsen burner, okay? We all know that term. So yes, he is the inventor of the Bunsen burner. Robert Wilhelm Bunsen, great, great guys, yeah. Okay, so what was their key discovery? Time moves faster, despite what Einstein said, when you're giving a talk like this. So what they discovered, the patterns of the dark lines in the sun's spectrum, those patterns coincided with the same patterns that Bunsen and Kirchhoff noticed when they burned up chemical elements in their laboratory in the Bunsen burner. Okay, the dark line patterns and the bright line patterns that were given off by incandescent glowing elements, chemical elements, they matched, and they realized that we can do a chemical analysis of the sun or even of a distant star by comparing the patterns of the lines, the dark lines that are present in a sun or star spectrum, First is the different patterns that they found for different chemical elements. In other words, we can tell what the stars are made of. Astronomers before this, they thought we would never know what the stars are made of, not even the sun. We're never going to get there. So as with the camera, amateur scientists had to come in and perfect the spectroscope for use with a telescope. So we have, again, the New Yorkers, Lewis Rutherford and Henry Draper. They took spectra of the sun and the stars. We have the husband-wife duo of William Huggins and Margaret Lindsay Huggins in England from the 1860s through the 1890s. They took photographs of spectra of stars and nebulae. So again, the spectroscope, you could look through it, but it's much better if you take a camera and record the spectrum. Okay, so the spectroscope and the camera then were made into one unitary instrument. So these two, the Hugginses, essentially define the practice of celestial spectroscopy. And then, like the camera, by 1900, this photographic enhanced spectroscope device, that became standard equipment in the observatory. But to make them really work together in the most effective way meant that we had to also improve the telescope. So astronomy's culminating step to modernity hinged on the telescope. To be fully effective, these instruments, the camera and the spectroscope, needed as much light as a telescope could possibly gather. And that meant making the telescopes big, literally wide. And so the first such real modern telescope that was big and accurate was the 100-inch wide reflector telescope that still sits on top of Mount Wilson in California. This telescope was made expressly for use with the camera and the spectroscope. You can look through it if you want, but that was an afterthought. It certainly was not something that was done for research. And so it was with that instrument, the 100-inch telescope, with the camera, with the spectroscope, that Edwin Hubble first determined in 1923 that the Andromeda Nebula was indeed outside the Milky Way, our Milky Way galaxy. And then, by extension, all the other spiral nebulae that Keeler had captured on his 1890s photographs were also other galaxies. And just to conclude then, in 1929, Hubble and his team discovered, using these new instruments, that the universe is expanding. The universe was not always around. It had a birth event. So with those discoveries, that's where I end the book, basically, with the discovery of the expanding universe, because from that point on, it's a straight shot to the modern telescopes and the modern methods that astronomers use today. And we really have to give thanks then to this band of starlight detectives, these amateur astronomers, inventors who selflessly spent their time bringing astronomy into the modern age. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Hirschfeld.